This is Bella Fleck with Snakes Alive, an animal tune of sorts, as we ease into today's edition of Talking Animals. My name's Duncan Strauss, here with our program that is devoted to all subjects in the animal kingdom. In just a few minutes, we'll be speaking with today's guest, Dr. Nicholas Dodman, the veterinarian, internationally recognized animal behaviorist, and author or editor of several books, most recently, Good Old Dog, Expert Advice for Keeping Your Aging Dog Happy, Healthy, and Comfortable. We'll discuss the book and find out more about the care and feeding of our aging dog friends when Dr. Dodman joins us in a few moments here on Talking Animals. And as usual, we'll also welcome your questions and comments at 813-239-9663 or by email at dj@wmnf.org. And indeed, if you have questions about an aging dog that lives with you and how best to care for them, diets, other issues that may have come up, we'll work those into our conversation with Dr. Dodman when he joins us in a few moments here on Talking Animals. Right now, it's time for some animal news, items, announcements, etc. And the risk of being a little too self-referential, I want to talk to you a little bit about the Talking Animals Festival, the new one that's on the horizon for April 3rd, 2011. 2011, whichever way you like to say the year. It's going to be again at Lowry Park, Banchill area, all those great, great trees and shade. We're going to hold it from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. There, once again, will be bands, all several great, great bands playing animal songs, be vendors and tablers, there'll be speakers, vegetarian and vegan food, there'll be contests, exhibitions, a raffle, silent auction, and much, much more. Applications, if you'd like to table at the Talking Animal Festival or be a vendor, can be downloaded from talkinganimals.net. That's the show website. And then at the upper right-hand side, there's a little area that indicates the festival page. So you can just click on that, and that'll take you right to some info and where you can download the form for either a nonprofit tabling or a vendor, artist, etc. to join us April 3rd. And also, if you'd like to be a sponsor, food vendor, volunteer, or otherwise have inquiries about the Talking Animals Festival, please email talkinganimals@wmnf.org. Thanks so much. Again, looking forward to that. April 3rd, Lowry Park. All right, let's step now into the Talking Animals Comedy Corner, which involves, of course, animal-oriented comedy. This is Derek Lenguinas with a piece called Animal Lover on today's Comedy Corner here on Talking Animals.
But I'm an animal lover, like I said. I love animals. Any animal lovers in the audience? By round of applause. I love animals. I think most of them taste pretty good. You know, some of you applauded. Some of you weren't too happy with that. And I understand the people who aren't too happy with that, because it is a hypocritical thing to say, to call yourself an animal lover on one hand and then eat them on the other, right? It's kind of like a cannibal referring to themselves as a people person. You know what I'm saying? You have very nice eyes, yeah. Do you mind if I eat them? That kind of thing. But I, you know, I'm trying to deal with that. I'm trying to cut out the meat, and I'm trying to get down just to the fish now. Just, you know, they don't, whatever, they're fish. I feel bad, though, I do, because I love animal shows. I really do. I love watching them on the Discovery Channel. And Giggly McGillicuddy over here. No, I do. I love animal shows. But I know that I've been watching too many, because I had a realization that I've just, all this information is, it's interesting, but it's not useful. Right? Like, it is. I can't use any of this. It's not going to better me, you know. I was watching a show on the Arctic, and they were talking about polar bears. And at one point they said that on account of the extreme cold, a polar bear's milk, the mother's milk, not the father's, is 48% fat, all right? Interesting, but not useful, you see. I can't use that information for my survival, for example. if I were ever stranded in the Arctic, you know, just freezing to death with my buddy Mike, you know. Hey, Mike, it's a polar bear. Did you know a polar bear's milk is 48% fat? No. You thinking what I'm thinking? No.
All right, that's Derek Glass with Linguinus with a piece called Animal Lover, taken from his CD, Vulnerable. I'm Duncan Strauss. This is Talking Animals. Our website is talkinganimals.net, where we make available all sorts of information, as well as archives and podcasts of past Talking Animals programs. We also have a link to the Talking Animals Facebook page. Why not like us? And our Twitter page. Please follow us. Plus, there's a place to subscribe to our email newsletter so we can keep you posted on forthcoming guest program news and more. That's all found at talkinganimals.net. It's nearly time to speak with today's guest, Dr. Nicholas Dodman, so let me outline a few things about him. As I mentioned earlier, he's a noted veterinarian, internationally recognized animal behaviorist, and author or editor of several books, most recently, Good Old Dog, Expert Advice for Keeping Your Aging Dog Happy, Healthy, and Comfortable. Good Old Dog was written by the faculty of the Cummings School of Veterinary Medicine at Tufts University, and edited by Dr. Dodman with Lawrence Linder. We'll field some listener calls and emails about older dogs, their diets, diseases, and more. Let's welcome now Dr. Nicholas Dodman to Talking Animals. Dr. Dodman, are you there, sir?
Yes, I certainly am.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today on Talking Animals, and appreciate your time. And in reading Good Old Dog, I mean, one sort of unspoken, I guess, through line that developed for me is the extent that faced with our dog's decline or medical problems, so many of us are sort of inclined to do the wrong thing, or at least draw the wrong conclusions, and that often doing the right thing, seeking the best help for our older dog friends, sometimes seems somewhat counterintuitive. For example, like the owners who don't want surgery or a procedure for fear of anesthesia for their older dogs, just kind of leaping ahead in their mind to sort of the worst case scenario, which you point out isn't necessarily as risky or challenging as they often assume it to be.
Yeah, that's true. And that's really the point of writing the book, because, we like to have an educated client, someone who kind of understands, and it would help people to, you know, handle things like maybe there might even be some vets who would say, you know, your dog's 13 years old, he's got a bad mouth, I think it's too risky to anesthetize him at this age. Whereas, as you say, that's not dangerous at all in the right hands. In fact, the state of anesthesia is probably safer than the state of being awake.
Wow.
I mean, you think about it. If you were unfortunate enough to be involved in a car accident and the emergency team ran up, came along, they would, first of all, put in an airway to secure your breathing. That's what you do during anesthesia. They would give you some oxygen. That's what you do during anesthesia. And they would support your circulation with IV fluids and so on. And that's what you do during anesthesia. So, in fact, you're cosseted on this blanket of complete control during anesthesia. But some people make a mistake. Like, even vets might say, make sure you hold water back from this dog for 12 hours before he comes in case he vomits. Well, if you have an older dog who's drinking a lot and has a bit of kidney disease, if you withhold water for 12 hours, you can put him into a uremic crisis.
Yeah, you've got a different problem on your hands.
Bad management.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, it really. I mean, that's the thing. And sort of, I guess on a related note, it's just important to note that you observe how people sort of, I guess, need to kind of recalibrate their expectations and sort of what constitutes good news sometimes when it comes to their aging dog friend and diagnosis and treatment of him or her. So how something like chemo that may extend a dog's life, say 6 to 12 months or so, should be viewed as a tremendous amount of time dog friend.
It's a good percentage of some dogs' lives.
Yeah, absolutely, and I think you get again people who, even though they've had that dog and maybe others for many, many years, thinking still kind of, I guess, more in human terms, like, wow, that seems like kind of a short time. Is that all the time I can get? And it's again just sort of an interesting thing that we just all have to kind of recalibrate what those figures and numbers mean and how that's actually can be very good news.
But we do have to think out carefully. When you're doing some procedure on an older dog, is you know, how much pain and suffering is it going to cause, you know, like risk-benefit,
yeah.
Versus how long is he going to get, and will he live a quality life, or will he be in pain? And some people have to figure in also how much it costs.
Yeah.
You know, for all of us, there's a limit to what we can just shell out on
sure.
the spur of the minute, and there's no Obama health care for dogs yet.
Touchy subject indeed. But let me just let our listeners know, this is Talking Animals. If you just tuned in, we're speaking with Dr. Nicholas Dodman, a veterinarian whose latest book project was editing Good Old Dog, Expert Advice for Keeping Your Aging Dog Healthy, Happy, and Comfortable. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or comment for Dr. Dodman, 813-239-9663, or you can email us that question or comment at dj@wmnf.org. Well, sort of, Dr. Dodman, this talk of you know, cancer diagnoses, various things, and treatment feels extra pertinent with some close friends whose dog, Dornal, just received a pretty serious diagnosis, one that raises some questions, I guess, about treatment and diagnosis. And I don't know if I could just outline a few aspects of that situation. I mean, I know, you know, you're obviously not able to see the dog, and you point out in the book the limitations of sort of trying to diagnose over the phone, but... This dog is an 8-year-old English foxhound. It's about 73 pounds. Had his spleen removed, and there was, I guess, a 16-inch circumference tumor diagnosed now, I guess, with malignant fibrous histiocytoma. And yet the biopsy of the liver and lymph nodes showed that there hadn't cancer had not metastasized, and nothing in the lungs, all the other organs pristine. So I guess, you know, to the extent you could even react to that sort of limited information, what do you think is likely ahead for Dornal, or what side of treatment might my friends expect or seek for him?
Now, did they say that it had it was fairly widely dispersed throughout the spleen?
You know, I guess I should have gotten a bit more information. I just felt like there was a 16-inch tumor there, but I don't know. I think something might have opened up or dispersed or burst at some point they found in the procedure. But yeah, I'm sorry to say I'm a little fuzzy on those details.
But it's a histiocytoma. It was involving the spleen, and
yeah.
the surgery was successful in removing presumably the whole spleen, including the tumor.
That's what I've been told, yes.
And they didn't detect any spread?
No.
So I would think the outlook was pretty good.
Oh, good.
I mean, we do talk about splenic tumors in the book.
Right. No, and I read that very carefully and looking for any specific, even further clues on this guy.
But some of those, you know, hemangiosarcoma, which is the you know, malignant type of tumor of the spleen that's kind of commonly occurs in certain breeds, I think very commonly in German Shepherds, and that thing is just almost a death sentence.
Yeah,
You can get hemangioma, which is a more benign version, and you can catch it early if it hasn't spread, but it's really not a good diagnosis. But a histiocytoma is a much nicer tumor. I mean, most histiocytomas, I understand, will regress.
Okay, because I know they were just thinking, well, there's, you know, there's a couple of bad outcomes, and malignant obviously is tied to any of those. But it sounds like this is sort of the good version of if there had to be a malignant part of this. So,
yeah, we have an entire oncology team here with, you know, people who are board certified, and they specialize in it. And, you know, these people were tapped, their information was tapped for the book. So, you know, I think the good thing about Good Old Dog is the fact that it is expert opinion from the experts at Tufts. So it's not like, you know, sort of no disrespect to Joe Blow, the veterinarian, writing his own opinion, but this is multiple opinions from people who are specialists in their field
the top.
About everything from literally nose to tail, from hearts to lungs to kidneys to bones to arthritis to I was sort of pretty instrumental, or actually instrumental, in the chapter on Alzheimer's, you know, so Alzheimer's.
No, there's so many things I want to get into, and I know there's some folks eager to speak to you. In fact, let's take one of our callers. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Dr. Dodman.
Hi there, is that me?
Yeah, that's you. Do you have a question for Dr. Dodman?
Yes. We have a 12-year-old golden retriever who has always had a certain hip dysplasia issues since she was young, and now that she's 12, they've obviously gotten worse, and her back legs are very weak. But she pants all the time, and I don't know if that's because of the pain. We've got her on 4 Tramadol a day to try to keep the pain down.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know if that's a symptom of something internal that we need to explore, or just controlling the pain at her late age is the way to go.
But was the panting occurring before you used the Tramadol?
Yes. In fact, it's better. It's not as bad as it was.
It's not as bad as it was.
No,
well,
no.
Panting in a dog that's not overheated and hasn't been running around and there's no sort of thermal reason for the panting usually indicates anxiety, and it could also indicate pain. So this dog is anxious and or in pain. The pain thing is much easier to treat, really, because there are these super painkillers these days. And you know, you think the Tramadol has produced some improvement so far, but you might want to try a different, you know, speaking with your vet, try a different painkiller, because some of these ones like Etogesic and Remedil, Deramax, they're really super powerful non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. You could even try, just for a temporary period of time, using a little cortisone. There's a tablet called Cortaba, which is a combination of aspirin and cortisone. But if you get the right combination of anti-inflammatory, analgesic, and Tramadol may not be the perfect one in this situation, you can eliminate whatever's arising pretty much from pain. But that doesn't
Remedil,
mean the anxiety is going to go away.
We tried Remedil, and we tried the injectable the injection stuff. I can't think of what it's called now. The Remedil didn't seem to have put a dent in it.
No. Yeah.
So
I mean,
you said analgesic and Cortaba?
What was that?
I'm writing these down as I'm driving.
Oh, Cortaba? I did. Don't do that.
Okay, we should probably scoot it. So, hopefully that answers.
Yeah, what happens when older dogs like that have anxiety and pant? There usually is some medical cause, and the dog may well have hip dysplasia, and maybe that is causing him some pain, but that may not be the whole explanation for this. So this dog needs a nose-to-tail examination. Being a golden, I would certainly check the thyroid function. I'd be looking out for any kind of tumors which can cause anxiety in older dogs as well. It may not be all referable to the hips. And if this woman wanted to check out the hips, you could do things like epidural morphine, which for a period of time will eliminate the pain in the back end, and see if it gets better. Not as a permanent treatment, just to find out whether it's the pain of the hips that's causing the problem.
Okay, cool. Well, thank you for your question, and thank you, of course, for your answer, Dr. Dobbin. And again, my guest is Dr. Nicholas Dobbin, a veterinarian whose latest book project was editing Good Old Dog, Expert Advice for Keeping Your Aging Dog Healthy, Happy, and Comfortable. And again, the faculty of the Cumming School of Veterinary Medicine at Tufts University all contributed to this. So as Dr. Dobbin noted, sort of all the top experts in the field are writing on all the pertinent topics for our older dog friends. We invite you to join the conversation, as some already have, and others look to be eager to do so, at 813-239-9663 or emailing dj@wmnf.org. And I'm going to take another call or two shortly here, but Dr. Dobbin, with all this talk, inevitably about various ailments and examinations and treatment and stuff, I'd like to talk for a sec about pet insurance. Because I think it's safe to say the book is pretty squarely in the pro pet insurance camp, which I found interesting, if maybe even mildly surprising. I guess I've sort of viewed, and I know a lot of people have, pet insurance as sort of somewhat akin to getting collision coverage when you rent a car. Like smart, overprotective, but not necessary. Maybe a judgment call at best. But the book really suggests it's money well spent. Maybe you could speak to that for a moment.
Yeah, I think when pet insurance first came out, there were a lot of problems with it, and it probably wasn't a smart thing to get it. But these days, the two major insurers who are in business have sort of figured out a lot of the issues, and it's not perfect. Like human health insurance, there are issues. But the thing is, you can have sort of exclusion clauses in there, so you're not covering yourself against sort of minor expenses that you could probably pay out of pocket. But you're covered for the major things, because these days, medicine is so expensive. I mean, it's really easy to drop $5,000 on a dog with a major surgery. And we've had people spend up to $60,000 on a dog. So, these kind of sums of money are just too much for a person to pay. And if you get insured for these, lightning strike, unfortunate conditions, you can pay a steady dribble of money per month, and then you don't have to ever pay this major thing.
Yeah.
Of course, that once you've made a major claim, you can end up getting dropped, same as happened in human insurance. But at least you're covered first time. And the other thing we suggest is you might want to be your own insurer, but if you start young enough, if your dog, when your dog's two, almost like a kid's college account, you put, you know, $20 or $30 a month into a fund. And if your dog doesn't need this medical care, you've got yourself a nice vacation. And if it does, it's there and you're covered.
Yeah, no, I really love that idea. And it just seems, as you say, that contingency is so crucial. If you don't need it, that's great. But also, just even as the point you make in the book, or someone makes in the book there about the added virtue of just even having to sort of, you know, avoiding the guilt of, you know, possibly having to put a dog down because you literally don't have the money to pay for the treatment, where under this rainy day fund idea, you're sitting on the money right there to help the...
There's nothing worse than being the vet who's standing there and, you know, for example, in our hospital, say, I've seen this case, a dog with gastric dilation, so his stomach has blown up and twisted.
Yeah.
An older dog, perhaps. And then the quote's given to the owners, so it's going to be, you know, $3,500 to $5,000 to fix this, and they just say, "I'm sorry, we can't afford it." And then you look into the dog's eyes, and the dog looks back at you, and they look at the dog, and the dog looks at them, and you're like, "How can this be?" So we do have an angel fund here that, if people genuinely are in hardship, they can get it paid through this angel fund. But some people, it's not that they don't have the money; they just don't want to spend it that way, and it's tragic to have a dog go down the river that way.
Wow. That's a pretty sad scene. You just catch there, Dr. Dodd.
Well, you know, some people actually surrender their dog to a shelter or a pound because it's too old.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't understand that. That's like, you know, shunting your grandma off to a home because she's, you know, reached 80.
Right. No, that's just truly awful. And, okay, well, let's, perhaps on a brighter note, let's take another call here. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Dr. Dodman.
Hi, is that me?
Yes, it's your turn. You have a question for Dr. Dodman.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I'm actually, you had mentioned, you know, looking into the dog's eyes, and how much of what we consider animal behavior is a projection of our own behavior or human behavior, and how can you really know? I mean, I know you can study ethology. How does one become, a dog behaviorist, since that is probably most what you concentrate on? And also, speaking of that, I have a 12-year-old lab who can no longer go up and down the stairs. I mean, he does sometimes, but he's losing that ability. How much of his dignity is affected by this? You know, speaking of animal behavior and what I'm projecting onto him, you know, is he just going with the flow? Is he okay? I mean, is he okay with this decline?
Well,
is it causing
worrying
me more anxiety than it is him?
He's probably worrying less than you.
Yes, I
but
thought.
This is the deal with the looking into their eyes and what they mean. I think they mean what you think they mean.
Right.
I'm not of the Skinnerian theory of you know, animals being sort of robotic, that they, you know, they press buttons and get rewards. I mean, as a matter of fact, if you want to argue that humans are the same, you know, we go to the bank because we get money, and we go to the food store because we get food. We're working on rewards, and things that are bad we avoid. So we're doing positive and negative reinforcement ourselves, but we're not robotic. We're thinking creatures, and so are dogs. And more it's gone from the sort of Skinnerian behaviorism through the ethologists who studied animals in the wild. But even then, you're missing out actually living in the company of animals, which is a totally different thing. And now there's been experiments, you know, from Harvard, Brian Hare's famous experiment with dogs following a pointing finger to find food under a bowl, that indicate that dogs actually are much more tuned in to us and our body language and things than you previously, at least scientists, have believed.
Yeah, I saw that on Nova.
Yeah,
they had special.
More and more. I mean, it was
even more so than chimpanzees, which
Than chimpanzees. So they're actually pretty amazing creatures, and so a lot of what you think about a dog and its thinking is true. Not all. So, for example, the feeling of disgust, which is ingrained in us when we're kids as a secondary emotion. Oh, that's disgusting. Dogs really don't have that because their mothers actually clean up poop by eating it.
Right.
So, you know, they're not trained to be disgusted by things that disgust us, and I think there's a lot of learning goes on to make us disgusted.
Right, conditioning.
But they're smart creatures. I mean, not as smart as us, that's for sure, but probably equivalent to like a three-year-old child. But if you've ever noticed, a three-year-old child is fairly manipulative, and they sort of know their own mind, and they can communicate pretty well.
For sure. Well, thank you so much for your call, and thanks again for your great response, Dr. Ubman. And I might even just add to that the question about the dog needing to be lifted. There's a section in the book cites an example of this gigantic, I think 60, 70-pound dog that was used to sleeping with its family upstairs, and the guy in the family every night, once it was unable to walk comfortably, carried the dog up, and well, the guy didn't have a problem with it. Obviously, the dog didn't have a problem with it, and seemed to work out great. And also, in another part of the book, there is a specific section, for example, about when a dog might have to face amputation, and how, as we sort of touched on here, the dog isn't really worried about, you know, as long as they can kind of move around and function nearly as much as their family, as their people.
That's true, and that information was provided by Dr. John Berg, who's my department chairman, and he is an orthopedic surgeon by trade and specialty, and he's done a lot of amputations, and in the book he says that he's never found an owner who's ever regretted having gone for an amputation surgery.
Yeah.
And the dogs, as you say, don't really mind, as long as postoperatively they have proper analgesics. When they find themselves a three-legged dog, they run around and pant and look happy and appear to laugh and eat their food, and all's well.
Sure, exactly. Well, we're just sort of nearing the end of our time here, Dr. Dobbin. Of course, got numerous other people who'd like to speak to you. Just want to touch on one other thing, just because there are often people sort of orbiting around a show like this who maintain that dogs can and should be vegetarian. Mm-hmm. The issue of vegetarian diets is addressed in no uncertain terms in this book, and maybe if you wouldn't mind just addressing it here briefly.
Well, dogs are actually omnivores, so people regard them as being carnivores, but that's not true. They're actually omnivores. They can eat a mixture of foods like us, animal, vegetable, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, dogs can live on vegetarian rations too. You can, just like with us, you can compile a vegetarian ration. It's probably not the best thing to do because, you know, there are certain components that are difficult to replace, and you've got to be fairly scientific about the vegetarian food that you feed. You've got to know a little bit about it in order to balance the dog system by feeding it vegetarian food.
And also, I think at one point in the section, just to really address how important that is if you are going to attempt that sort of diet, there was a mention of in one dog's case, and I'm sure this represents, you know, many others, that where a vegetarian diet that someone put their dog on actually caused heart disease, if I remember that correctly.
Yeah, that's right, because if people try to do strange things and think that the dogs are people and that they can do the same thing that they do to people, and it's just not true. Dog's a dog. It has its own specific requirements of certain amino acids and so on, and if you don't know that and you just make this switch on sort of some high principle grounds, you can actually do the dog a huge disservice and make it unhealthy.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Dobbin, we have indeed at this point, unfortunately, reached the end of our time. And again, there's a lot of disappointed callers that we just didn't get time to have them at opportunity to ask you a question. But maybe we'll be lucky enough to have you on the show again sometime down the road. Meanwhile, the book is Good Old Dog, Expert Advice for Keeping Your Aging Dog Happy, Healthy, and Comfortable. And again, I just found it really just so, you know, well done and well written and, you know, yet, you know, aimed obviously at sort of a lay audience, but obviously some very important technical things that are well covered there, and just really indispensable for any of us who have older dogs or will have older dogs in our lives. So
that's cool. Well, thank you for having me on. I think it is a good book. It fills a much needed niche that's been ignored so far, because more and more dogs are becoming elderly thanks to good care and good nutrition, and people like to hang on to them and do the best by their old friend.
Absolutely. Well, again, thank you for your time, Dr. Dobbin, and good luck to you.
Thank you.
All right, bye-bye now.
Bye.
All right. I'm Duncan Strauss. You are listening to Talking Animals, where the show website is talkinganimals.net. It's time to proceed to name that animal tune. There'll be a prize, a Talking Animals Festival t-shirt from the first festival, to the first person who calls 813-239-9663 and correctly identifies this animal tune, which is also marking a little bit of a notable passing today as well. Let's name that animal tune on Talking Animals. All right, we have just about reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals. We'll take the guesses off the air. This is the final Talking Animals of 2010. Currently, the program airs twice a month, specifically the first and second Wednesday of each month. So we'll return Wednesday, January 5th, when we'll likely do a program tied to Ringling Brothers' local engagement that'll open that night, something I've done annually all the way back to the first years of the show in California in 2003. So I hope you'll join me then, January 5th, right here on WMNF. Talking Animals broadcast outreach consultant is Libby McKenna. My thanks to her. I'm Duncan Strauss. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good week. Be kind to animals. Be kind to others. Be kind to yourself. Happy holidays to you and yours. And we're closing out today's show, as always, with an animal tune. Seemed like it should be a dog song of sorts. And this is. This is Jamie Johnson with Dog in the Yard on WMNF Tampa. See you in 2011. Thanks for listening.
You don't have to keep me on no chain. I come around when I hear you call my name. I must not be too hard to train. Took you no time at all. You don't really like none of my friends. You never really know just where I've been. When I slip up on your porch at 4 a.m. like an old stray dog. So you scratch me, you pet me, and you bite me and even let me win now and then. Scold me, you tease me, then you hold me and tell me I'm your friend. Well, making love to you, babe, ain't so hard. You treat me like a dog in the yard. Sometimes you kick at me when I'm down. It drives you crazy when I just.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi.